The Legal Sunday, The Constitutional Aspect of the Question, Chapter 3. The same continued, objections to the ground that Sunday laws are necessary and proper for the physical benefit of the compulsory idler. It is plain, then, that Sunday laws are neither necessary nor designed to protect the physical rest, the only kind of rest within the law's province, of one person from being disturbed by another. It remains to examine the validity of the claim that they are either designed or necessary to compel the individual to remain idle on one day in seven for his own physical benefit. This is a favorite ground of defense for Sunday laws, especially in the later cases. We are told that we are so constituted physically that the precise portion of time indicated by the Decalogue must be observed as a day of rest and relaxation. And nature, in the punishment inflicted for a violation of our physical laws, adds her sanction to the positive law promulgated at Sinai. 1 Lindenmuller's case, 548. And so precisely are we constituted in this regard that, whereas if we fail to loaf away 1/7 of our time, we shall be punished by nature, yet it would be prejudicial to the public and tend to idleness if 2/7 of the time were devoted to rest. 2 B&O's case, Virginia, 36. Bearing in mind that public here evidently refers to the individual resters and not to the body corporate as an entire thing, and comparing this extract with that immediately preceding, we find a remarkable physical law judicially established. We may fail to see how the prejudice to the public caused by making Sunday idleness compulsory differs in kind when 2 days' idleness in each week is required by law from the prejudice caused when the requirement is confined to 1 day. It differs in degree, of course, but the first is only the greater of two evils. To rob a man of his right to labor truly to earn his own living on 104 days in the year is worse than to forbid him that privilege for 52 days. But it by no means follows that the latter proceeding is good. It would seem that, if one requirement tends to idleness, the other must necessarily tend in the same direction. But this consideration will be dealt with hereafter. For the present, it is sufficient to call attention to the scientific accuracy of the law of nature as extracted from these two citations. It smacks of mathematical precision, like the law of gravitation, Kepler's law, Dalton's hypothesis, etc., etc. We must idle 1 day per week, or we cannot physically be saved. We must not idle more than 1 day in the week, or we shall physically be lost. What more definite, clear-cut enunciation could the most logical mind require? That it is a discovery made by the hygiologists of the bench, and remains unknown even now to all other experts in physiology and biology, cannot detract from the glory of those who have not only ascertained the fact, but have expressed it so comprehensively, yet with such terseness and lucidity. The judges who have ascertained and promulgated this wonderful truth of our being are, it must be admitted, in a minority even among the pundits of the bench. But, whether from jealousy or ignorance, many judges have come very near supporting this view, and yet failed to give it full endorsement, or at least to express it as dogmatically and as precisely as it is here laid down. Most of the cases of the class which we are now considering do not seem to be decided on the principle that 1 day's idleness per week is necessary and 2 days' idleness is deadly, but their claim generally goes merely to this extent, that we shall be stronger, healthier, and longer lived than otherwise if we idle once a week. So, we are told that Sunday laws are passed to prevent servile work, which is exhausting to the body. 1 Landers v. R.R., P.R., N.S., 338. And because the laboring part of the community must feel the institution of a day of rest as peculiarly adapted to invigorate their bodies for fresh exertions of activity. 2 Watts' case, and R., 48. Here again, we will concede the facts in order to examine into their value. Because work is servile, the application of this invidious word will also be considered hereafter, and because it is exhausting to the body, and because idleness is invigorating, may an American legislature therefore forbid the serf to earn his living at any time and to swallow against his will the tonic of a day's loafing? This is paternalism, suitable enough for Russia, where the elders of a village were lately flogged on their bare backs because of a deficiency in the town taxes, and nobody was particularly disturbed about it. But it sounds strangely enough as a principle of American law. The freedom of an American citizen to labor when he will, how long he will, at what price he will, is commonly supposed to be part of his inheritance, won by his ancestors back from the feudal tyrants who had stolen it from their ancestors. Into this inheritance he comes when he attains his majority. Its sole limitation is that he shall not, by his labor, interfere with others. Where does an American legislature get its right to step into the place of those robber barons of the olden time and filch away the worker's right to judge for himself what is exhausting his body, and the obligation which may be upon him to exhaust it in labor, servile or otherwise? It has happened, though by no means in every case where the distinction has been claimed for the deceased by two partial friends, that a man has literally worked himself to death from his own greed, from the lust of fame, from a sense of duty for the sake of his loved ones. The question whether or not he is called upon to do this lies between the man and his conscience. The question whether he is actually doing it is for his physician. At what point does the concern of the legislature with such an affair begin? It lies among the very foundation stones of our system of law that it never begins at all. The founders of our republic were especially jealous of legislative encroachment. The tendency of the legislative branch of any free government to dominate the other branches, and the fact that under such a system the real danger to individual liberty is in this tendency and not in the judicial and executive powers, were things well known to Jefferson and his contemporaries. Nor were object lessons wanting. They knew the British theory of parliamentary omnipotence. They knew the British history of how Parliament had made itself practically omnipotent and supreme over kings and judges by reason of its control of the nation's purse strings. And while in form their rebellion was against King George, in fact it was caused by the manifestation, as against them, of the same aggressive, self-exalting, power-monopolizing spirit which had even in their day placed the executive and judiciary departments under the heel of the legislative branch of the English government. Accordingly, when they framed their own governments, the colonists were particularly careful to hedge about the legislative branches with express restrictions of many and various kinds. So, while we find it often said that the governor may do this, or the court shall do that, thou shalt not is the command invariably addressed to the legislature. And wisdom is justified of her children herein. The Federal Congress and the state legislatures have fully equaled the British Parliament in their aggressiveness, not only against the other departments of government, but against the people as well. Congress has, at least once, shown a determination to have its own way in spite of judicial opposition. The Constitution provides that there shall be a Supreme Court, but it does not name the number of judges who shall constitute the court. Congress once took advantage of this omission to pack that tribunal in order to accomplish its ends. The court pronounced an act of Congress unconstitutional, whereupon Congress increased the number of the judges, a subservient president appointed to the new places, lawyers known to hold the opposite view of the act. A new case was made up, and the constitutionality of the act was affirmed in due course. And thus did Congress reverse the Supreme Court and force upon the judicial branch of the government its own view of the extent of its own powers. This procedure is likely to be repeated whenever the Supreme Court seriously interferes with the liberty of Congress to legislate as it pleases. The sins of the state legislatures in this regard of self-exaltation and conscienceless intrusion upon the domain of governors and courts, as well as oppressive restrictions on individual liberty, would fill many volumes if detailed. The state constitutions usually specify the number of the judges and courts, the boundaries of their jurisdictions, etc., so that the connection between the state judiciary and the legislature is less intimate than that existing between Congress and the federal judiciary system. Yet a powerful and baleful influence is often indirectly brought to bear by legislatures on the courts of a state in order to override constitutional barriers. Nor have the courts always shown a disposition to resist to the utmost the legislative ambition. It may be said that they are keenest to see and oppose intrusion upon their own domain, less zealous when the executive department is invaded, and least of all concerned where the sole object of the legislature's aggression is a personal right or privilege of the private citizen. It is especially in cases of this latter kind that the courts have largely destroyed their own usefulness as guardians of the people's liberties, by laying down two principles as binding upon them when considering the constitutionality of a statute. The first principle is that an American legislature possesses the omnipotence of the British Parliament, except so far as it has been abridged, expressly or impliedly, by the establishment of the federal or state government. They say that the powers of the judiciary and executive are given, the powers of the legislature are restrained. So that if a judge or governor does a thing, his right to do it must be shown if questioned. Whereas, if the legislature does a thing, the objector, to establish his case, must show that, somewhere or other, the right to do it is denied. There is usually no excuse for making any distinction whatever between the legislative and the other branches of government in this important matter. The analogy of the British system will not hold. The conception, as well as the entire body of constitutional law as we know it in America, is American, and not for one whit of it are we indebted to England. The question of the constitutionality of a statute which is constantly arising here could not arise in that country at all. The British Parliament is a part of the British Constitution. It is not its creature. It has been, indeed, largely its creator. It is its only amender. An unconstitutional act of Parliament is a contradiction in terms, according to our law, because we understand by an unconstitutional legislative act one which is absolutely null and void. But the phrase has a meaning for the English lawyer. He understands at once that it applies to any parliamentary act involving the exercise of a power not before exercised by Parliament, and is thus rather extra-constitutional than unconstitutional, corresponding to what we should call a constitutional amendment. But an extra-constitutional act of Parliament is as valid as an act passed in the exercise of functions already recognized as belonging to the parliamentary body. Thus we see in the British Parliament a depositary of that absolutism which has been deposited nowhere under our system, but has been absolutely withheld. In England, the last resort is the Parliament. With us, the last arbiter is the people. The nearest approach we have to the omnipotent British Parliament in the way of a representative assembly is the Constitutional Convention. But even the work of the Constitutional Convention must be approved by the people before it can become law. And as to an American legislature, it has no part or lot whatever in the making of a constitution, though it may ask the people at any time if they will be graciously pleased to amend the same. The legislature is itself the creature of the Constitution. The creature cannot be greater than the creator. If it derives its very existence from the Constitution, it would seem self-evident that from the Constitution alone it must derive every capacity which it possesses. The law of its being is the only law of its action. And thus we see that there is no foundation for the assumption that an American legislature, as such, is possessed of any degree of parliamentary omnipotence, or differs in the least from an American judge or executive in the obligation which rests upon it to show, in the written Constitution, either an expressed or an implied grant of every power which it presumes to exercise. But it has been said that in nearly every American state, the common law of England is expressly adopted, and that legislative omnipotence is a part of that law. In the first place, as already stated, the qualifying words, so far as applicable, usually follow the assertion of a right to the common law. But even without any qualification whatever, the adoption of that law must be taken in connection with other provisions in a Bill of Rights, and the terms must be interpreted so as to harmonize with the rest upon the principle of construction as a whole. We have seen that, where we find in one clause an unqualified adoption of the common law of England, and in another, a declaration that there shall be no union of church and state, no church can be established by law, though the established church is part of the common law of England. And so, when we find in almost all the constitutions an adoption of the common law, standing side by side with a solemn declaration that because the people have enumerated certain rights, they are not therefore to be prejudiced in respect to other rights retained by them, we see that the parliamentary omnipotence of England has no place in a government born of such a constitution, though parliamentary omnipotence be the very cornerstone of English common law. And there are other provisions of our constitutions which are altogether inconsistent with any distinction whatever between the legislature and the other branches of the government, in respect of the obligation to show an authority for its acts. Indeed, among the parts of the common law which we have expressly repudiated is this very doctrine of legislative superiority. The English Parliament is a court as well as a legislature. But it is the American view that the legislative, judicial, and executive branches of the government ought to be and remain forever distinct. One house of the British Parliament has for its normal and by far its most important function the sitting as a court of last resort. But the judiciary's absolute independence of the legislature is no less a fundamental principle with us than its absolute separation therefrom. Here, then, is a very important qualification to be considered in connection with an adoption of the common law, however general in its terms. And the disregard of this qualification, the surrender of their equal dignity in the face of its express guarantee, which is involved in the recognition of legislative omnipotence, where restraint does not appear, is indeed a most remarkable instance of self-abnegation on the part of our courts. Equality between the two branches absolutely demands that an act of the legislature shall be approached as freely and as impartially by the courts as the act of an individual, and that the mere fact that a statute has been passed by a legislature shall have no more influence upon the decision of its constitutionality than the mere fact that a thing has been done by a respectable citizen ought to have upon the decision respecting its legality. Indeed, a moment's consideration shows us that any other rule involves more than a degradation of the judiciary from its proper plane of perfect equality with the legislature. It involves a complete abdication of judicial functions. It makes of the legislature a court of final resort to solve the doubts with which the judges confess themselves unable to deal, and allows the members of the legislature to be the judges in their own cases, and to take into their hands the law which the courts acknowledge that they are incompetent to administer. If, then, doubtful cases arise, as arise they must, since legislatures, language, and courts are human, surely all this presents a sufficient reason for the courts declining in such cases to be influenced by the view of the one party, the legislature, that it has the right to exert a particular constraint on the other party to the dispute, namely, the individual citizen, and justifies the court in solving the doubt for itself, instead of thus referring it to the first party for solution. And surely, in so solving it, the court is bound to solve it in favor of the individual, upon the principle already enunciated that every American government, state and federal, is one of delegated and limited powers. Again, the view that the legislature may do anything which it is not expressly or impliedly forbidden to do violates the principles of the law of agency on which the American theory of government is based. American governments did not grow like the government of England. They were made. They are not principles like Parliament or even general agents. They are special agents in their entirety, and each branch is a special agent for its specific business. It is a common saying that the federal government is one of delegated powers, while the powers of the state governments are original. There is a peculiar sense in which the powers of the federal government may be called delegated. It is confined, as other governments are not confined, in its sphere and its operations. But it by no means follows, and it is not in fact true, that the governments of the states are altogether unconfined. The federal constitution reserves to the states or the people the powers it does not grant. This reservation to the states is its peculiar feature herein. but the reservation to the people of the powers not by them granted to their state governments is, in some phraseology or other, made in the Constitution of nearly every state of our Union. Bills of Rights preface all these instruments, and these uniformly contain a solemn warning to legislatures and judges alike that the enumeration of rights therein contained shall not be construed to deny other rights retained by the people. This negatives at once the idea that the English theory of parliamentary omnipotence can be applied in America in reference to the whole government of a state, and it as conclusively forbids the application to the acts of an American legislature of any other test of legality than the test which is proper alike for the acts of the judiciary and the acts of the executive, the question being properly put, not in the form, "Is authority to do this act anywhere denied?" but in the form, "Is authority to do this act anywhere expressly or impliedly given?" Some reliance for the position that the legislature may do anything which it is not forbidden expressly or impliedly to do has been found in the fact already mentioned, that the provisions regarding the legislature generally consist of restrictions upon its action, whereas those referring to the other departments of the government usually consist of grants of powers. It is argued that here is an implied recognition of a fundamental difference between the legislature on one side and the executive and judiciary on the other, and of the theory that the last two can claim no authority which is not given, whereas the first may do anything not forbidden. This is specious, but not solid. It is, as has been shown, inconsistent with the spirit of our institutions. And it is also inconsistent with other provisions in our Bills of Rights, and therefore cannot stand under the principle of construction as a whole. But furthermore, no such recognition of the superior dignity of the legislative branch is inferable from the distinctive character of the provisions respecting it. There are good grounds for maintaining that the framing of those provisions in the negative justifies the courts rather in a zealous scrutiny of legislative action than in a disposition to concede its validity. The number, no less than the terms of these inhibitions on the legislature, certainly attest the profound mistrust of such bodies which permeated the minds of the people. It has been noted that these inhibitions are mostly concerned with proceedings which Parliament had never undertaken for America, though some of the colonists had doubtless suffered personally in England from such legislation as is forbidden in Bills of Rights. But our forefathers knew as well as we know, and appreciated as we do not appreciate in this remote time, the story of parliamentary oppression and tyranny as practiced for many a year on English soil. And having this knowledge and appreciation strong upon them, they seem to have all agreed with Jefferson in the conception that their liberties were in no danger from either the executive or the judiciary under such a system of government as they proposed to construct, so that few express prohibitions were necessary to keep these branches harmless, whereas legislative encroachment not only against the other departments, but against the individual citizen, was an ever-present peril, needing many and strong safeguards of a specific sort, besides the general reservation of rights retained, which undoubtedly is mainly designed as a restriction upon the legislature. The courts, then, if inspired with the true feeling of their masters, the people, will be chary of binding themselves by any assumption which may throw wide the door to the aggressions of the legislative branch, and strictly order their course by the great American principle that government, in totality and every part, is a delegated agent for certain purposes, which to exceed is usurpation. Closely connected with this fallacious principle of legislative omnipotence, wherever there appears no express or implied restraint, is the equally unfortunate rule that the courts will always hold a statute constitutional in a doubtful case. In fact, the two things are mutually inclusive. The result of either, and of both, is to shift the burden of proof from the legislature to which it belongs on to the shoulders of the citizen, where it has no business to rest. Only an attorney can appreciate the full significance of this question of burden of proof and the tremendous results which follow from laying it on one side of a controversy, whether of law or fact, rather than on another. We have seen that the courts have degraded themselves by their extravagant view of legislative authority. If the self-inflicted indignity hurt the courts alone, the matter would be of less importance than it is. But the citizen is also concerned. He must be necessarily injured by the surrender of the equality between the branches of his government for which he expressly stipulated when he established it. As already remarked, it involves a weakening of that barrier against legislative aggression which he intended to erect when he provided for a separate and independent judiciary. But besides this, which is the concern of every citizen, the individual who is denying the constitutionality of any particular statute is specially aggrieved. The state, or rather the legislature, is on one side of a controversy, and he is on the other. The question in whose favor the decision ought to be must very often be doubtful, since constitutions, statutes, and judges are things of humanity. What reason can be given for always holding in such case that the statute is constitutional? It is believed to be demonstrable that true Americanism requires us to decide every such case precisely the other way. To give the legislature the benefit of the doubt, as the saying is, in such a case, is considered as a courtesy due to a branch of the government, coequal in dignity with the court itself. Now, it may be questioned whether such an individual thing as courtesy can exist or be practiced between two abstractions. A judge may be courteous to a legislator, but it is not easy to see how a court, as such, can be courteous to a legislature as such. Nor is it quite clear with what moral propriety a question of courtesy can be allowed to affect the discharge of a dry official duty, or why a judge, when called upon to say whether a legislature has violated the law, should deem it consistent with his oath to allow his conclusions to be affected by considerations of courtesy, any more than when he is called upon to decide whether a citizen has violated the law. But, bating all this, the exercise of courtesy is out of place where the welfare and happiness of other people than the parties are directly at stake. So that, though the courts should be ever so courteous in allowing the legislature, in a doubtful case, to usurp judicial functions, and though they should extend this courtesy to legislative attempts to hamper and impede the executive, where the latter would seem to have the better claim, if courtesy is to be consulted at all. And though the courts may thus indirectly deprive the people of the benefit of the most important among the services which the people have established courts to perform, yet courtesy cannot be legitimately invoked to justify the concession of a doubtful power when its exercise consists in a direct infringement of a personal privilege held by a private citizen. And the reason is plain enough. With us, it is not the legislature which resembles the parliament, in that it needs show no grant of right to do anything that it chooses. The individual citizen is the inheritor of this absolute authority in free America. He it is that existed before the Constitution, and that made the Constitution, which, in turn, gave birth to the legislature. Before he made the Constitution, he could do anything that he pleased, so far as the law was concerned, for the Constitution is the beginning of law. But before the Constitution was made, the legislature could not even exist, and of course could do nothing at all. When the citizen, then, undertakes to do a certain thing, he is not obliged to show a lawful warrant for doing it, in the Constitution or statutes, because he derives neither his existence nor faculties from any such source. The burden is on the disputer of his warrant in doing the thing, to show that the Constitution or some statute has deprived the doer of his natural right to act as he did. This fundamental principle of American law is perfectly understood and consistently applied in our criminal jurisprudence. The advisability, in a civilization largely dominated by feminine sentimentalism, of holding the state to its ancient obligation of establishing, beyond a reasonable doubt, the guilt of a prisoner, has been seriously questioned. It is argued by some thinkers that substantial justice would be now better subserved if the decision were made in criminal, as it is in civil cases, according to a mere preponderance of the testimony, either way. But however this may be now, it is certain that in the iron times, when this principle became fixed in the law, it was rightly considered as a necessary and most efficient safeguard against oppression and outrage. The doubts of old were mostly about the facts. The law was usually clear enough, and, as already indicated, its constitutionality could not be questioned. But many American statutes are verbose and cloudy, and the conditions of modern life give rise to cases of great intricacy, so that we have more trouble than our ancestors, both in getting at the facts and in determining the law's application. But the courts have consistently applied the old rule of the burden of proof to the new doubts thus created. The state must prove its law and the application thereof to the facts after it has first proven the facts themselves. Before it can punish a man for anything that he has done, it must show not only that he did it, but that a law exists forbidding him to do it. The presumption is against his violation of the law, but it is nonetheless against the infringement by the law of his personal liberty. And among the doubts righteously thrown in a prisoner's favor is every reasonable doubt in the court's mind as to whether the law under which he is arraigned applies to the circumstances of his case. The same righteous principle obviously requires that whenever there is a question between that creature of the Constitution, the legislature, and that progenitor of Constitution and legislature alike, the individual citizen, the right of the former to interfere with the latter, or to coerce him in any manner shall not be presumed, but every reasonable presumption shall be made the other way, and that the citizen shall not be required to refer to the Constitution, which is no part of the law of his being, to vindicate his liberty, but the legislature shall be required to refer to the Constitution, which is the entire law of its being, in order to vindicate its right to abridge that liberty. It may be conceded that the legislature ought to be presumed to believe in the constitutionality of any statute that it passes. Just so, the intent of a private citizen to violate the law is never assumed and must be proven, inferentially or otherwise. But the law is no respecter of persons. The intent necessary to justify the punishment of a citizen must be proven to the same extent and will be inferred from the same circumstances. In the case of one prisoner, as in the case of another. And the judges who are sworn to give the people the benefit of the law and its protection against the aggressions of the legislature, no less than against aggressions by one citizen on the rights of another, are not at liberty, in the discharge of that duty, to respect that abstract personage, the legislature, whose actions may come under their purview. The proper influence of courtesy in either case has this extent and no more. Upon the question whether the act itself of an individual is in violation of law, courtesy has no bearing whatever. But where the certain intent essential to constitute the violation of law is not presumed from the act, then courtesy demands that this intent shall not be imputed to legislature or individuals, but must be proven. To go further in either case is to become a respecter of persons. Mr. Smith may be a highly respectable citizen, and Mr. Jones, a professional tramp. But the presumption of intent, like the presumption of act, is, in the theory of American law, whatever its practice under the jury system, precisely the same for Smith and Jones. And so the legislature may be, and no doubt in many cases is, a highly respectable body. But this is no reason why its construction of its own powers should influence the judges upon that subject. To permit it to do so is at once to lay aside the judicial frame of mind and to approach the consideration of a statute with a bias fatal to the administration of strict justice. This way of throwing on the citizen the burden of satisfying the court that the legislature has wrongfully placed a new restriction on his liberty, instead of compelling the legislature to adduce conclusive proof that it had the authority of law for imposing the restriction, is also inconsistent with reservations of American constitutions, which are clearly intended in the main to restrict legislative aggression, and which may be generally described as the guarantees of rights of property in one's person and one's things, the right of the citizen to be secure in his person and property. The statement that no person ought to be deprived of his liberty or property without due process of law, and so on. English history shows us the effect designed by those who used such language in the constitutions of the first states, from which it has been copied substantially into those of our later governments. The design was to restrain the legislature from interfering at its discretion with the personal freedom of the citizen, with his use or disposal of his person or his possessions. The English Parliament had often interfered with these things. In consequence of its action, men had been repeatedly punished without trial and property taken without process. Similar actions are forbidden to American legislatures. And the effect of such provisions as we are now considering is not merely to forbid acts of this kind, but to require the courts to determine whether or not a certain act of the legislature is of the kind without the slightest reference to the view which the legislature may have taken of the subject, as shown by its passage of the act. For, until the act is passed and has come before the court to be adjudicated, the question of legislative usurpation cannot arise. And the effect of these, or any other constitutional provisions under which the fact of usurpation is claimed, will be obviously minimized, if not nullified altogether, by holding that the mere fact that the thing was done is presumptive evidence that no usurpation was committed. This digression, though somewhat lengthy, is not out of place in a book whose purpose is to make a general as well as special plea for individual liberty, and it has a particular reference to the question of the sustainment of Sunday laws on secular grounds. We are now about to see how, by repeated hammering, though daylight has not been let in, yet in some cases a glimmering doubt has penetrated the judicial mind whether, after all, these laws can be proven to be valid exercises of legislative authority. And, in such cases, they have sought shelter behind the two principles which we have been considering, the residuum of omnipotence inherited by American legislatures from the English Parliament, and the favorable ruling on constitutionality in a doubtful case. The influence of these two fallacies is easily enough perceived in Sunday law cases, as in others, even when they are not mentioned in terms. Thus we are told that the legislature has the power to prohibit work on Sunday as a matter pertaining to the civil well-being of the community, 1 Melbourne v. Usley, c. 356. As though the fact that a thing pertains to the civil well-being of the community were an all-sufficient reason for claiming that an American legislature has the power to do it. It is not to be presumed that a legislature will pass a bill which does not, in its judgment, conduce to the civil well-being of the community. But what are all the constitutional restrictions of the power of American legislatures for, except to limit the judgment of these bodies upon this very point? With many things the people have said in advance that the legislature shall have nothing whatever to do, however closely these things may pertain to the civil well-being. Yet, despite all such restrictions, we find it laid down regarding Sunday idleness that, whether the power to require it ought to be exercised, depends on the legislature's sense of the public good, 1 Sellers v. Dugan, 180-489. Thus making their sense of the public good the sole and conclusive test of the constitutional authority to act. As already shown, courtesy demands the assumption that the legislature intends its every act for the public good, so that if this intent is conclusive of the act's constitutionality, we are indeed in the condition of England under its Parliament, and there is no power in an American court to restrain the omnipotence of a legislature. But it is plain enough that all such reasoning as this utterly misses the gist of the matter. Of course, before they can pronounce a statute constitutional or unconstitutional, the courts must ascertain its intent. That is, they must determine what the legislature intends to do before they can decide whether or not the legislature may lawfully do it. But, while the courts must deal with legislative intent, nothing is better settled than that with legislative motive, the courts will have nothing whatever to do. 2. See Ex parte McCardle, 506, Doyle v. Continental Suss, Company, S. 535. The distinction may be well illustrated by the case in hand. The legislature makes idleness on Sunday compulsory. It has been shown that the result is to demoralize and debauch the citizens. But though this end were the real inspiring motive of the legislature, it would not, in the slightest degree, affect the question of the constitutionality of its action. On the other hand, the legislature may really administer Sunday idleness under the belief that it is a moral and physical prophylactic, But the influence of this motive would constitute no reason for holding that such administration was within its functions. In other words, the courts consider merely what the legislature wants to do, and then whether the thing may be done. Why the legislature wants to do any particular thing, the courts will never inquire. In a California report, we find it said that the legislature has the power to repress what is hurtful to the public good, and must generally be the exclusive judge of what is or is not hurtful. 1 Andrews Case, 678. But why should the word generally be used when the general power of the legislature to determine such matters has never been denied? General principles of legislative action are dealt with in treatises on abstract law, but they are never mooted in court. The issue of constitutionality is made not in regard to the legislature's general freedom, or its general obligation to repress what is hurtful to the general good. Its cardinal rule, the controlling and guiding purpose of everything that it does, should be the public good. The welfare of the people is the highest law for the legislature, but all this within the limited and prescribed sphere of its lawful actions. It may and should generally, nay, always, in the discharge of its functions, judge of what is or is not hurtful. And within its sphere, too, it is the exclusive judge. Neither the judiciary nor the executive can decline, the one to sustain, the other to enforce, a legislative act because of its seeming hurtfulness to the public. This is a question of public policy, and the legislature, like the judiciary and the executive, is the sole and exclusive judge of the public policy of its own proceedings. The public policy of compulsory Sunday idleness has already been considered, but with no reference to the constitutionality of Sunday laws, their expediency being then alone under review. But now, while the legislature is always the judge, and always the exclusive judge of the public policy or expediency of its own proceedings, it is never the judge at all, in any American state, of the constitutionality of those proceedings. This is a different matter altogether from the other, and is as exclusively a matter of the courts as the other is a matter of the legislature. The question, then, being not the public policy, but the constitutionality of compulsory Sunday idleness, let us briefly examine the last point, without confusing it with the first. One of the strongest arguments against Sunday laws is their inconsistency with those constitutional provisions already alluded to regarding infringements on what may be called the liberties of person and property. This would be perfectly conclusive if all other arguments were wanting. It is undeniable that a law which forbids a man to labor for his living at any time that he may feel able and disposed or in duty bound to do so seriously infringes a valuable liberty of person. It is undeniable that a law which compels a man to close his place of business at a certain time seriously infringes a valuable liberty of property. Now, every Sunday law does both of these things, and every Sunday law must therefore stand or fall by the test of the legislature's constitutional authority to do them both in the given case. We have seen that under our American system, the existence of legislative power to make these infringements is not to be presumed, but must be proven. And that if the case be doubtful, the benefit of the doubt must be given to the liberties and not to the infringements. Will the assertion of legislative power in the given case stand the test of these principles? We read, "It is exclusively for the legislature to determine what acts should be prohibited as dangerous to the community." 1 Lindenmuller's Case, 548. And that the right to the use of one's premises must be exercised in such a manner as not to affect prejudicially the tranquility or morality of the local public. 2. Hague's Case, PR 76. Here, then, we have the justification for the special legislative infringements on our liberties of person and property, known as Sunday laws. My private labor or the sale of my goods may be forbidden because it is dangerous and disturbs the tranquility or morality of other people. Let us waive the question of morality and concede both these propositions as they stand. Is it conceivable that the same labor can be dangerous on Sunday and safe at any other time? Is not the absurdity of such a notion patent on its face? Again, what sort of tranquility is it that is affected prejudicially on Sunday by work and business and remains all the rest of the week undisturbed by the same labor and business? The nature of this tranquility is fully demonstrated in the preceding chapter, where it is shown to be simply the mental tranquility which is born of the consciousness that other people are behaving under compulsion of law, as we believe that it is their religious duty to behave. And it is there also shown that this particular kind of tranquility is not and cannot be brought within the protection of American law. As to the morality, it will probably be admitted that if it is really governed by the almanac, so that it is affected prejudicially by labor and business on one day and not on another, it is a morality so fluctuating and uncertain in its nature that it is hardly worth preserving. But the idle Sunday does not really belong to the domain of morality. As has been well said, it is in no just sense a moral sentiment at all which impels us to the observance of Sunday for religious purposes more than any other day. It is but education and habit in the main, certainly. Moral feeling might dictate the devotion of a portion of our time to religious rites and solemnities, but could never indicate any particular time above all others. We see, then, that neither danger, tranquility, nor morality demand or justify legislative infringement of the liberties of person and property by the passage of Sunday laws. The point is made clearer when we consider the general class of legislative powers to which these infringements have been referred. It is said that they are valid under the police power. 1 Frolickstein's case, 725. This is supposed to be something inherent in every government by virtue of its existence, a necessary attribute of all civil authority, a power born with the state and essential to its being. The phrase is extra-constitutional altogether. In no American constitution are any police powers conferred by that name either on the government as a whole or any part of it. The phrase is objectionable at all times, because it is suggestive of violence, as well as of unlimited possibilities in the way of oppression. Well has Judge Christiansey said, powers which can only be justified on this specific ground, and which would otherwise be clearly prohibited by the Constitution, can be such only as are clearly necessary to the safety, comfort, and well-being of society, or so imperatively required by the public necessity as to lead to the rational and satisfactory conclusion that the framers of the Constitution could not, as men of ordinary prudence and foresight, have intended to prohibit their exercise in the particular case, notwithstanding the wording of the prohibition would otherwise include it. 2 Walker's case, 281. And, though the use of this objectionable phrase be unfortunately rooted in our law, yet it is not to be juggled with in order to attribute to an American government any power not expressly or impliedly conferred upon it by the Constitution, the law of its being, nor to deprive the people of the benefit of their solemn declaration that the enumeration of certain of their rights in that Constitution shall not be construed as a surrender of other rights retained by them. Grant that the police power is an essential attribute of every government. The fact remains that with us, all governmental powers, like all governmental existence, depend on the Constitution and are defined and limited thereby. If the Constitution says that my liberties of person and property shall not be infringed except under certain limitations and with certain formalities, then the government cannot justify its forbidden infringement of those liberties by invoking this specter of the police power as a mysterious entity outside of and above the Constitution, a source of authority higher than the people, and which has invested their servants with powers over them which the people never bestowed, and which are pregnant with illimitable mischief. The police power, in fact, for us, means really nothing more than the power of the government. If the government has a power, it may exercise the same, whatever the power may be styled. But because a power may be rightly called police, it no more follows that an American government may rightly exercise the power than it follows that such a government may do whatever public policy in its judgment requires to be done. The domiciliary visit and administrative process, which are well-recognized exertions of the police power in Russia, are not admissible here. We see, then, that for an American government, the claim of police power amounts to nothing but the claim of a power, the validity of which must be tested by the Constitution. So that power without the adjective is just as good as with it, and the phrase has no real meaning when the constitutionality of any governmental proceeding is in question.
This principle applies as well to each branch of the government as to its entirety. But the phrase police powers is especially out of place when applied to legislative acts. We have provided carefully for the separation of the three branches of the government and have decreed that the functions of each shall, as far as possible, be its own exclusively. Now, police powers are essentially executive. To take care that the laws are faithfully executed, that duty prescribed for the governor in most constitutions involves the police power. The phrase has no proper connection with the making of laws, which is the business of the legislature. If we substitute functions for powers, we see at once the force of this distinction. And, as the legislature has no police functions to perform, it is evident that it has, properly speaking, no police powers under which it may act. The police power, or better, the power of an American government as a whole, is, then, somehow and somewhat limited. Let us, for the sake of argument, concede the whole phrase police power and consider what its limitations may be. First of all, as just indicated, it is subject to any express restrictions on governmental action found in the Constitution. But the general spirit which inspires these restrictions, the whole theory of delegated powers, throws a yet heavier restraint upon government. There are only two ways in which any branch of the government can infringe upon individual liberty: either arbitrarily, at its caprice, without being called upon to give any reason whatever for its actions, or under fixed rules and principles, to be defined and applied by some other branch, through whose decree its infringements may be nullified. When all three branches of the government conspire in the use of the police power to oppress the citizen, his only resort is the ballot or revolution. But normally, each branch acts, as it is designed to act, as a check against the intrusion of the other branches on its own domain and upon the liberties of the citizen. The governor, with his veto, is frequently an efficient and valuable check on legislative aggression. But our chief reliance in this regard must always be the courts, upon which we are also sometimes forced to depend for protection against executive usurpation as well as legislative. The courts, then, constitute a tribunal before which the exercise of the police power, so-called, by the legislature or executive, must be defended when challenged. Now, what is the test whereby the courts are to determine whether or not a liberty of person or property has been lawfully infringed in a challenged case by either of the other branches of the government under the police power? It has been said that the limitations of this power are hard to define, but it is possible that we may discover a touchstone by which we can test the claim of any particular act to constitutional validity hereunder. As already indicated, the law administered by an American government cannot concern itself in any way with religious, spiritual, or mental injuries. And this last word at once suggests a still more important limitation on the police power, in fact, the primary and fundamental limitation of all. There must, then, be a secular injury involved in the exercise of a liberty of person or property to justify its infringement under the police power of an American government. Now, this idea of an injury, from its very nature, requires that some other person than the doer of an act shall be affected by its doing, and this is the only sense in which the word injury can be used in American law. Here, then, is the primary and fundamental limitation of the police power with us, that it can infringe a liberty of person or property for one reason alone, namely, that if the liberty were allowed to one person, a secular injury would result to another. The maxim, sic utere tuo ut alienum non ledas, so use what is yours as not to injure another, defines and exhausts the whole police power of a free American government. Under that power, it may deal with actions and inactions so far as they affect the relations of the citizens with each other, or with regard to treason, etc., against itself. it cannot go one step beyond these limitations. This is not a matter of theory. It results from the very nature of a free government, from the necessities of the case. A government which undertakes to do more than this, to restrict the liberty of person and property with reference to the individual, at once ceases to be free and becomes paternal and despotic. The secular view, then, of Sunday laws is a wrong view. First, in that it assumes compulsory idleness to be necessary or even desirable from a secular standpoint, so far as others than the reluctant idler are concerned. Secondly, in that it assumes that compulsory idleness on Sunday is necessary or even desirable so far as the reluctant idler is concerned. And thirdly, in that it assumes that if compulsory idleness on Sunday were necessary or desirable either for others than the reluctant idler or for the reluctant idler himself, or both, this consideration would justify an American legislature in making idleness on Sunday compulsory. But this secular view of Sunday laws is not only wrong in these premises and in this conclusion, it is also wrong, it is shamefully, pitifully wrong, in that it is an afterthought of the courts, born of an intellectual dishonesty which can only be held sincere by crediting the heart at the expense of the brains of our judges. For it must be that any judge whose knowledge is not the slave of his zeal for Brownism is fully aware that not a single Sunday law has ever been passed, and not a single prosecution under a Sunday law has ever been made with the slightest reference to the secular aspect of the subject, or from the slightest regard for the secular advantages of Sunday idleness to the compulsory idler or to anybody else. He knows, what Mr. Tiedemann truthfully says, that the enactment and enforcement of Sunday laws have no other origin and inspiration than the spirit of New England, which in colonial days imposed a fine for absence from public worship. That every such law does, in fact, exist, and exist only because of the religious character of the day, and that no such law ever has existed or ever will exist for any economical reason. See Tiedemann's Limitations of the Police Power, pages 275-276. Knowing all this perfectly well, knowing that the origin and spirit and purpose and aim of all Sunday laws from the first to the last is simply to prefer the Brownist type of the Puritan type of the Christian type of religion to all other types, and to force an outward deference to a peculiar dogma of that religion upon those who do not accept the dogma or believe in the religion. Knowing perfectly well that this is an unconstitutional purpose for an American legislature to cherish or accomplish, and that is both cherished and accomplished in every Sunday law of these American states. Knowing all these things perfectly well, is it competent for the courts to go beyond them? Is it competent for them to say, here is an attempt of the legislature to do what it is expressly forbidden to do. Here is a practical success in that attempt, but all this is immaterial, provided that, in the course of accomplishing this illegal purpose, the legislature has indirectly also accomplished something else which it by no means intended, but which it had the power to do directly had it been so disposed. This monstrous position has actually been taken in the course of the desperate judicial efforts to support Sunday laws on secular grounds. Says one judge, it may be conceded that the acts prohibited are only prohibited because they are such as would be offensive to public morals according to the standard of Christianity, 1 Kayser's case, 177, meaning Brownism. And another, though it may have been a motive with the lawmakers to prohibit the profanation of a day regarded by them as sacred, and certainly there are expressions used in the statute that justify this conclusion, it is not perceived how this fact can vitally affect the question at issue, 2 Specht's case, 312, meaning the constitutionality of a Brownist Sunday law, which in both these cases was sustained, notwithstanding the admissions quoted. As has been said, this position is monstrous. Judge Cooley rightly observes, a court or legislature which should allow a change of public sentiment to influence it in giving to a written constitution a construction not warranted by the intention of its founders would be justly charged with reckless disregard of official oath and public duty. Thus, if a statute is passed with a view of giving a forbidden preference to a certain religion, and its enforcement necessarily involves the giving of such preference, the statute is void. That it may incidentally accomplish other purposes legitimately within the purview of the legislature will not save it. To postulate these last as the motives and foundations of its passage, when one knows that the postulate is utterly false, is surely a great scandal and reproach to our judiciary. Yet this is just what is done in the class of cases now under consideration. Driven out of the position that these acts are legitimate manifestations of the Christianity inherent in American law, the courts actually fall back upon the proposition that they are measures of hygiene and therefore constitutional. Now, not only does what Judge Cooley here says about a written constitution apply also to a statute, but what he says about a change of public sentiment applies with equal force to an awakening of the public consciousness. Sunday laws were first passed in the United States on religious grounds alone. The inspiration of the most recent Sunday laws is the same as that of the first. It is not so much a change of public sentiment, though that is an important and a daily growing force on the right side, as an awakening of the public consciousness to the true character and meaning of these laws, which is forcing on the issue of their repeal. The awakening public consciousness is grasping the fact that Sunday laws are intended to constitute, and do in fact constitute, a preference of one religion over another. The public conscience will soon demand their repeal for this reason. What can we say then, but that those judges are justly chargeable with reckless disregard of official oath and public duty, who, in order to check this just demand and preserve these foul blots on American statute books, permit themselves the subterfuge of pretending that Sunday laws are based on secular grounds, thereby giving them what they know to be a construction not warranted by the intention of the makers and supporters of these statutes. Again, it is not law which any court would dare to lay down, except in Sunday cases, that a statute which is passed to accomplish an unconstitutional purpose and which cannot be enforced without accomplishing that purpose is to be sustained because, as an incident or accident of its accomplishment, some result is reached which was not contemplated, but which the legislature might have accomplished constitutionally by a different statute. We have seen in this chapter that if Sunday laws were designed for the hygienic benefit of the reluctant idler, or, being otherwise designed, incidentally accomplished that benefit, neither the design nor the incidental result would render them constitutional. We have seen that it is historically false that the original Sabbath laws had the slightest reference to hygienic considerations. It remains to show here that the falsehood of this secular defense of Sunday laws is quite as apparent from their contents as from their history. So that judges who appeal to this afterthought of the holiday theory, as it is sometimes called, deliberately close their eyes not merely to the history, but to the very language of the statute before them. It is a fact that in order to sustain a Sunday law on secular grounds, it is necessary not merely to defy history, old and recent, but also to ignore the very language of the statute itself. Up to this point, barring the occasional mention of the idle and cheerless Sunday, the Brownist Sunday law has been uniformly spoken of as if it interfered solely with the liberty of labor and business. This has been done from the conscientious desire to give its defenders the advantage of the strongest position which their case can occupy. It is, naturally enough, a favorite position with them. Whatever fallacies may be urged on behalf of a Sunday law with any degree of plausibility can be urged from this position alone. Indefensible as it is, when assailed by common sense, this position may at least be occupied and held until fired on. But there is another position which no intelligent Brownist has ventured to take for many a day upon this subject, and yet which must necessarily be taken and defended if Sunday laws are to be justified. Everything alleged concerning the secular advantage resulting from interference by these laws with the liberties of labor and business might be conceded, and it might further be conceded that this secular advantage was an all-sufficient reason for their enactment by an American legislature. And yet the rightful presence of a Sunday law upon an American statute book would remain as far as ever from being established. the interference with the liberties of labor and business is only one half, and perhaps the least objectionable half, of a Brownist Sunday law. Every Brownist Sunday law interferes with the liberty of play also. This double interference is essential to the very nature of a Brownist Sunday law. And unless a statute at one and the same time prohibits work and play, then, whatever else it may be, it is not a Brownist Sunday law at all. And the Brownist Sunday law with this combined prohibition is the only Sunday law with which we in the United States are concerned. It is worth noting in this connection that the very first Brownist Sunday law passed in England, 1623, said not a word about work, but proclaimed that the holy keeping of the Lord's Day was profaned by people going to bear baiting, bull baiting, interludes, common plays, and other unlawful exercises and practices. And with such play, not work, it proceeded to interfere. The next thing aimed at was traveling. And it was not till 9 years after the first act that worldly work was forbidden to be done without reasonable cause, a liberal saving enough for the times. And a century and a half elapsed after the passage of the first Brownist Sunday law before any work of one's ordinary calling, with the famous savings of necessity and charity, was forbidden on Sunday. The combined prohibition of work and play, then, is found in all of our American Sunday laws. And this last characteristic of their Sunday laws, intelligent Brownists fight very shy of discussing. They prate at length of the heat of business competition, the poor, overworked laborer, the need of rest, and all that sort of thing, when they know that the very contents of their Sunday laws conclusively refute the idea that they are passed to mitigate any such conditions as these. When they know that if the legislature was exercising the paternal function which the passage of such laws involves, for the physical benefit of its children, the adult citizens, it would extend its paternalism from the prohibition of work to the utmost possible encouragement of play. For that play is a far better antidote to the corrosive effects of work than mere idling, euphoniously called rest, is an axiom of physiology. Hence, if there were any truth in the idea that Sunday laws are passed and enforced on secular grounds, then a Sunday law enacted by a legislature composed of sensible men, and what American legislature was ever otherwise composed, would not have its prohibitions of work combined with prohibitions of play, but rather supplemented by provisions designed to make play on Sunday specially easy and attractive. Such, for instance, as requirements that all public institutions, libraries and museums and the like, should be open all day, that all theaters should give matinee performances at half price, that railroads and steamboats should run excursions at reduced rates, and so on. What candid Brownist will not admit that in such a law, a true secular Sunday law, he would find heresy, blasphemy, diabolism pure and simple? A surrender of the state to the powers of darkness, a thing to be detested and fought against in season and out of season. And not only is it true that this combined prohibition of work and play conclusively refutes the suggestion that Sunday laws are based on ideas of secular benefit to reluctant idlers, but there is strong ground for the belief that, if the advocates of such laws had to part with either of these prohibitions, they would prefer to have the prohibition of work repealed rather than the prohibition of play. The fact that play and not work was the first thing legislated against by their intellectual ancestors points strongly to this conclusion. And there is another purpose, not equally important with the flattery administered to the Brownist egotism by the state's recognition of his religion, but still an essential element of his interest in Sunday laws. This secondary yet vital purpose is, by depriving people of other occupation, to indirectly drive them into church as the only refuge from the unendurable ennui of rest. And it naturally occurs to the astute Brownist that to allow play and prohibit work would probably tend less to drive people into church than to allow work and prohibit play. And again, the egotism of the Brownist, which it is the main object of the Sunday laws to flatter, requires that people shall be compelled to follow his way as far as possible on his weekly Sabbath. They cannot now be directly compelled to follow his way of going several times to church and to his church, as he would have them compelled to do if he could, and did compel them to as long as he could in New England. But he hates play, being naturally gloomy, morose, and sour of disposition, as all true Brownists must be. And his way on Sunday, whether in church or outside, is to be more of a Brownist than on other days. That is to say, to be more averse to play, and more gloomy, morose, and sour. Now the mere compulsory abstention from play on Sunday, while it equals the compulsory abstaining from work, as a tribute to the superior excellence of the Brownist religion, is unquestionably better adapted than is the abstaining from work to throw others into the gloomy, morose, and sour condition of mind, which is the characteristic Brownist condition. Thus, in a Brownist-dominated town, when a stranger takes his walk through the streets on Sunday, he finds it not always easy to discriminate between the voluntary Brownist idler and the involuntary non-Brownist idler. The scowl of the first, worn as a religious rite or observance, being closely imitated by the frown of the second, worn by way of protest, not so much against Brownist interference with his liberty of work, as against Brownist interference with his liberty of play. So the superficial Brownists, at least, are made by this last interference out of the reluctant idlers. And to cleanse the outside of the platter, while preserving a stolid indifference to the condition of the inside, is as much a characteristic tendency of modern Brownism as it was of the Pharisees and Sadducees of old. And finally, this prohibition of play embodies more of the spirit of persecution, which is the life of all Sunday laws, and another essential characteristic of Brownism, than the prohibition of work. The Brownist's idea of his mission on earth is that he was born to set other people straight and keep them so, that is, to compel them to go his way. If they will not go his way, his first idea is to kill them, if he can, as the Brownists of New England massacred the Indians. When the public opinion of non-Brownists among whom he lives becomes so strong that this pleasant duty is denied him, he unwillingly falls back on mutilation, such as the Brownists of New England inflicted on the Quaker men and women. When even mutilation has been made impossible, then he can do no better than try to content himself with making life as uncomfortable as possible for the wretches whom he cannot get at in any other way. And this is the Brownist spirit of persecution that survives in our Sunday laws. And this is the spirit which is more pleasantly pandered to by forbidding play than by forbidding work. The wretch who will not go to church on Sunday might conceivably be made uncomfortable by requiring him to do extra work on that day, but a certain amount of inconvenience by way of punishment for his contumacy can undoubtedly be inflicted on him by forbidding him to do any work, however much he may need the money he might earn for himself or others dependent on him. In fact, the greater his need, the greater his punishment. But that he shall be sentenced to spend 24 hours in every week in moping and misery, in self-tormenting thoughts and uncongenial idleness, in a confinement of soul and body worse than that of any jail, this pleasant result of his non-Brownism can only be reached by that exquisitely and perfectly diabolical Brownist device, the combined prohibition of work and play contained in our American Sunday laws. And whether the Brownist most values the prohibition of play or the prohibition of work in his Sunday law, the first must evidently be retained as long as the second is retained. Since to forbid the non-Brownist wretch to work and at the same time permit him to play would utterly defeat the persecuting purpose of Sunday laws, and, so far from rendering him as uncomfortable as possible by way of penalty for his non-Brownism, might even result in his becoming more comfortable on Sunday than on other days, and actually looking forward to its recurrence with pleasure as an occasion when he would have an extra degree of liberty and be able to enjoy himself after the fashion most agreeable to himself.